What we were designing was a system where users had this privacy utilizing zero-knowledge proofs, and every private transaction that one performed generated an encrypted transaction that was stored on-chain. And then we had a dedicated network of nodes that, using MPC, was able to screen those transactions, essentially. But importantly, there was no trusted entity that could screen or block a transaction. It was the network as a whole that ran secure multi-party computations over those encrypted transactions, arbitrary program execution in a confidential encrypted way, but to also have the program itself be fully encrypted and to have encrypted random access memory, this sort of replacement for you purchasing some trusted execution environment. Now you can use this global supercomputer to execute anything.
If you're looking to stake your crypto with confidence, look no further than Chorus One. More than 150,000 delegators, including institutions like BitGo, Pantera Capital, and Ledger, trust Chorus One with their assets. They support over 50 blockchains and are leaders in governance on networks like Cosmos, ensuring your stake is responsibly managed. Thanks to their advanced MEV research, you can also enjoy the highest staking rewards. You can stake directly from your preferred wallet, set up a white label node, restake your assets on Eigenlayer or Symbiotic, or use their SDK for multi-chain staking in your app. Learn more at chorus.one and start staking today.
This episode is proudly brought to you by Gnosis, a collective dedicated to advancing a decentralized future. Gnosis leads innovation with Circles, Gnosis Pay, and Metri, reshaping open banking and money. With Hashi and Gnosis VPN, they're building a more resilient, privacy-focused internet. If you're looking for an L1 to launch your project, Gnosis Chain offers the same development environment as Ethereum with lower transaction fees. It's supported by over 200,000 validators, making Gnosis Chain a reliable and credibly neutral foundation for your applications. Gnosis DAO drives Gnosis governance, where every voice matters. Join the Gnosis community in the Gnosis DAO forum today. Deploy on the EVM-compatible Gnosis chain or secure the network with just one GNO and affordable hardware. Start your decentralization journey today at gnosis.io. Welcome to Epicenter, the show which talks about the technologies, projects, and people driving decentralization and the global blockchain revolution. I'm Sebastian Couture, and I'm here with my co-host, Felix Lutsch. Today, we're speaking with Yannick Schade. He's the CEO and co-founder of Arqueum. It is a private compute platform that allows for all sorts of interesting use cases, privacy in crypto and beyond. So we'll be chatting with him today about Arqueum, the architecture, their use of MPC, and much more. Yannick, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Sebastian and Felix. I'm very excited.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about your background and how you got involved in the encryption and privacy space and how you ended up working on Arqueum.
Yeah, sure. So I think the reason why I'm in the space of building Arqueum, building confidential computing, decentralized confidential computing, and privacy technology, at the end of the day, it might boil down to me as a small child reading 1984. I think that might be the honest answer. I think that really shaped my perception of the world and my views of how the world should work and how privacy and freedom matters. Reading that as a child, I think really, really influenced me. At a similar age, I started programming, teaching myself programming, then studied law for a bit, and then through founding my first startup, pivoted to mathematics and computer science in the process, away from studying just law. Through the study of mathematics and computer science, I met my co-founders, basically all of us caring about elliptic curves at that point, because that's what we learned about in university, and then getting into zero knowledge proofs. And through the process of that, ended up founding Arqueum, which back then was called Elusive. And yeah, with Elusive, we focused on building transactional on-chain privacy. And with the added twist, I guess, of adding trustless, decentralized compliance, so that there's both privacy and still safety on the end of the users. So unwanted illicit behavior could be excluded from this on-chain privacy architecture. And for that, we leveraged confidential computing with secure multi-party computations. And through the process of designing the system and building this technology, what we realized is the huge potential and the revolutionary potential of being able to run arbitrary computations over encrypted data without having to decrypt the data first. So data in use can remain fully encrypted and anything can be processed on top of that data. And so that was really a pivotal moment, this realization for us. Which then allowed us to evolve further into Archeum and fully focus just on providing this, what we like to call distributed global supercomputer that allows for confidential computing.
Awesome. Thanks for the quick overview. We're going to dive a lot into Archeum over the course of this, of course. I think for me also interesting, because that's like how I got to know you, I think, working on Elusive. And also like working in the Solana ecosystem. Can you maybe break down how you started in Solana and you know, kind of how you came to the conclusion to add this like compliance angle? I think that was like kind of like one of the main differentiators there in what you were building over in Solana.
Yeah, sure. I think how we got into Solana is the story of many teams that are building on Solana. It was really the developer ecosystem. The final co-founder of our team, actually, I met at a Solana hacker house. So in the year 22, there were a lot of hacker houses and this really allowed developers wanting to build new interesting projects to meet up, to talk with experienced founders and then test the systems that they were building. So that's what we also did, how we came about building on Solana. Back in the day with Elusive, what we were building was essentially a Zcash-like on-chain privacy system, which utilized zero knowledge proofs as core primitive. And the issue that basically all of those systems face at some point really is compliance concerns, right? Because we've seen that with Tornado Cash essentially, right? So with Tornado Cash, there were enforcement actions by different governmental agencies because, they claimed that Tornado Cash didn't prevent malicious behavior on the platform. And if one utilizes mathematics to provide perfect privacy guarantees. That's the issue that they run into. And so what we were designing was a system where users had this privacy utilizing zero knowledge proofs, and every private transaction that one performed generated an encrypted transaction that was stored on chain. And then we had a dedicated network of nodes that using MPC was able to screen those transactions essentially. But importantly, there was no trusted entity that could screen or block a transaction. It was the network as a whole that ran secure multi-party computations over those encrypted transactions. And essentially within a black box, this virtual black box, were able to look into the transactions and assess what happened. And then they could find external consensus over malicious parties that tried to use that system, and then after the fact reveal the corresponding information, and so that was extremely powerful because prior systems really attempted to add compliance by screening transactions upfront, and with this system's a screening after the fact ex post was possible, which I think would be the ideal solution. And that's something that is possible to build with Archeum. But we really realized that, I think through the technology that we were developing, and we'll dive more into this later, I guess, but the complexity of this MPC technology, I think there was just one area we had to focus on, and we really saw our strengths in building this computing platform and optimizing the compute both for trustlessness but also performance. And so that's what we ended up doing.
Yeah, and you know, in the case of you mentioned Tornado Cache, like when I heard about that, I couldn't help but be reminded of the cypherpunk stories of the 90s. You know, we had Mark Miller on the podcast tell us about how he used to print the RSA algorithm on T-shirts because the U.S. government considered that encryption technologies were considered under U.S. law to be weapons, like to be munitions, and so therefore you couldn't export them. And there was this whole legal threat and sort of threat of persecution on those people in the 90s. You know, that were simply just freely expressing ideas and more to the point, like just making math public. And so like I heard that, the Tornado Cache story, and like it felt to me like very similar, where these guys basically like wrote math. This stuff exists. It cannot be stopped. And I think that we'll look back on Tornado Cache in the same way that we look back on, the cypherpunks in the 90s and what they were doing. There's really, little one can do to prevent malicious activity when you're using encrypted technologies. And I think it's like a huge societal debate, but I hope one that, people that sort of subscribe to the idea that encryption, is just freedom of speech and, is sort of like a right. I hope that, those people will fall on the right side of history. You said earlier you came into this space and you were kind of inspired to work in crypto, having read 1984. How did it make you feel that, you were sort of constrained to build a technology that enabled compliance when, you had such this, this very strong background and sort of ideological pedigree of like non-compliance in that sense?
Yeah, so I think that so first of all, I am 100% on this cypherpunk track. I think one of my greatest accomplishments in the privacy space would be getting my entire family to use Signal and having the entire family group chat be present on Signal instead of WhatsApp. So I think this compliance question is an interesting one. And the way I think about it really is that we gave control in the hands of the people using it at the end of the day. There was no external action of enforcing compliance. It was essentially being able to have distributed consensus and giving users the option to use whatever system. So it's the design that we designed back in the day with Elusive really was decentralized compliance. So no centralized actor should be able to have any control. It should be the users that have control. And I think at the end of the day, and we never ended up getting to this point to see that in action and experience those game theory and network effects. But I think at the end of the day, it boils down to, do users want specific other users using the servers for specific kinds of use cases? And I think it's a bit more easy to have these mechanisms with those financial mechanisms attached, whereas it's way more different if it's just pure expression of ideas, right? So I think that's a system that made sense, that at the end of the day found a natural equilibrium between both ends.
Yeah, it's hard not to also bring up the whole story around the Telegram founder who was arrested in France I think like last week. Any thoughts on that and what it means for the for the state of privacy technologies in Europe?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it's very difficult to say. I think Telegram is difficult. It's difficult for me because on the encryption side of things, Telegram always, especially in more mainstream media, I think, is being portrayed as this super encrypted private chatting platform that cannot be hacked. Whereas in reality, there's no default encrypted chatting between two peers, right? I think the story is difficult.
Yeah, it's interesting to see. At least, like, you know, here in France, I've been watching mainstream media talk about Telegram as this encrypted messaging. In fact, they don't even use the word encrypted. They use this other word that in French that doesn't even mean encrypted. It's not even, you know, it's as if they were calling it a cyber messenger instead of an encrypted messenger. And it's really painted as this kind of like black box thing, right? That you can tell that the story is spun in such a way when, in fact, you know, like anybody who uses WhatsApp, you know, is in fact using, you know, encrypted technology, and anybody who uses Apple Messenger is using encrypted technology, and Telegram is really painted with this very negative sort of lens. So it's interesting to see how, you know, even the mainstream media here, and I'm sure probably in Germany and other places as well, is like very biased against these technologies for some reason. But anyway, not to make this all about that, you know, we do want to talk about Archaeum and what you guys are building. So let's talk about, you know, confidential computing. So, you know, what does that mean, and what are the different ways that, you know, it has been implemented in the past, and what's kind of new about the way you guys are going about building it?
So yeah, I think confidential computing has been around for quite some time already, and at the end of the day, it means that computations can be performed over encrypted data without having to decrypt that data. So it's about so-called data in use, right? We have data in rest, which just lies encrypted on some hard drive, but data in use is the data that actively is being used in a computation. And so confidential computing allows for that data in use to be secure. That's what confidential computing tries to achieve. And there's different use cases, I guess, for confidential computing. For one, creating a secure execution environment, right? Having sensitive data, critical business data, for example, right? That has to be executed over in some cloud environment. And if that data were to be leaked, bad things could happen to companies, enterprises, governments, or individuals. So building secure execution environments. At the same time, confidential computing allows for data collaboration, essentially. So individuals can have their data remain private while being able to interact with others. So those are two core aspects of what confidential computing tries to achieve. And there are different kinds of technologies that have been utilized in the past to achieve this. And I think the most prominent one so far has always been trusted execution environments. A few months back, I was in San Francisco at the so-called Confidential Computing Summit, which essentially is just a conference of trusted execution environment manufacturers, and Intel, Microsoft, all those folks there praising their trusted execution environment technology. And I gave a talk there and I called it "Trusted Execution is Dead and We Have Killed It." And so my take really is that there's new kinds of technologies now that can replace those legacy systems that require trust. So what we're trying to achieve at Archaeum, and what the entire decentralized confidential computing DCC movement, I think, to some degree is trying to achieve, is to add more trustlessness to confidential computing. And in our case, that's by utilizing multi-party computation.
So maybe you can
kind of, I guess, bringing up the TEs already, and we have seen over the years a lot of different types of attacks on these. I think, like side channel attack, kind of supply chain attacks, and still, like you're saying, right, in this summit, everyone's talking about that. I think also in the crypto space right now, TE seems to have another sort of resurgence and popularity. Is that, or like, you know, why is that maybe? And how does MPC improve on that? Or like, how do you, tackle that at Arcium? Like, sort of, and maybe explain also a little bit what these types of attacks actually are.
Yeah, sure. So trusted execution environments are dedicated hardware that comes with security and privacy promises, essentially from the manufacturers. Usually that's dedicated hardware chips that have those secure enclaves, is what it's called. So virtual machines within those chips, where data should remain secure, encrypted, and cannot be accessed outside of that enclave. And an enclave has a code base associated with it. So only this specific code base can be executed over that state, which sounds like a great concept, sounds like a difficult to realize concept at the same time, thinking about exploits and hackers. So those systems suffer from many problems. I think the most easy to grasp problem is the complexity of building architectures on top of trusted execution environments. Anyone who has worked with TEs will tell you that it's very difficult to build secure code on top of those enclaves, because developers really have to ensure that data is being handled correctly, and they need to give rigorous attention to detail, that the boundaries between the secure and non-secure environments are being respected, and that also at the same time brings increased time to market, I think, because there needs to be a very very thought through development processes. And those systems at the same time also on their own come with quite high costs associated. It's dedicated hardware, and dedicated hardware that requires specialized folks that are able to maintain and develop on those platforms. Those are more of the soft factors that I don't like about working with trusted execution environments. The bigger problems really are associated with the trust model. As the name already communicates, the execution here is trusted. And the trust model, in my opinion, is fundamentally flawed, because, as you said, TEs are really susceptible to a whole range of more or less sophisticated attacks. And I don't know if you guys saw this, but 1.5 weeks ago, something like that, I think there was some researcher on Twitter that was able to extract the root provisioning key from some Intel SGX family processors, which is a key that can be used to fake so-called attestation reports. So trusted execution environments require this process of attestation, where they prove to you that they are a real trusted execution environment and you can trust this environment, so you can send your data in an encrypted way to that environment. And this attestation service requires some third-party trust. Regardless, on the processor side of things, there's side-channel attacks and hardware vulnerabilities. And side-channel attacks really boil down to you as the person having access to the processor, or you being able to just track the execution of some program execution. And through this process of being able to look at, for example, power consumption or tracking other metadata, I guess, that gets exposed through the execution of a program, be able to understand the execution path in a program, right? So if you think of an if-else statement, and if some condition holds something complex is being executed. It takes 1 hour. And in the else case, the program just ends. If the computation takes 1 hour, you will know, okay, the condition was true because the first branch was executed. And so that's the most simple form of performing a side channel attack, right? And so those processors are prone to these kinds of side channel attacks, and there's many exploits that have occurred in the past and many fixes for those exploits, but it's always new exploits that get identified. So in the blockchain space, we've seen a number of those kinds of exploits, actually. I think the most notable one would have been Secret Network. I think that was end of 22, where there, I think it was called a seed key or something like that, some master key that was shared between all the nodes in the network, all the TEs there, was exfiltrated. And then anyone who ever ran a node in the network would have been able to remove the privacy of all transactions, right? So there's this inherent danger of side channel attacks, firmware, microcode, and SDK bugs. It's just this large development stack with incredible complexity, and both on the hardware but also on the software, firmware, microcode level, where at the end of the day, humans are building those systems. And so humans, in most cases, are also able to exfiltrate information. Those are one kind of exploits, but I think more important is, as you mentioned, Felix, supply chains. Because when someone trusts a trusted execution environment, they're trusting a supply chain, a usually proprietary supply chain, which at the end of the day is just a chain of single points of failure. Single points of failure that can occur in the attestation process, can occur in the manufacturing process. And I think a very striking example of how trusted these systems are is when Apple unveiled their private cloud computing platform, which is their own TEs that they supply for model inference for their Apple Intelligence. I think something that they stated in their docs, in their release article, was something like, okay, they physically ensure that the machines from the factory get placed in their data center, right? So you can imagine people standing there with their assault rifles, protecting crates of computer chips, which is insane, right? If that's the trust model that you're working with, that there has been someone that was able to physically guard this chip from A to B, I think that's not something that that we should put all of our trust in.
So I wanted to ask you about, like, because, you know, we've been focusing on SGX here, and I think, like, in crypto at least, you know, SGX has gotten a lot of negative attention because of the secret hack and some other issues. And, like, I'm here on the Wikipedia page for Intel SGX, and there's about, you know, a dozen different attack vulnerabilities that are mentioned. But so why is it then that, you know, we never hear of, like, the Apple TEE in our phones being compromised, or, you know, even perhaps more interestingly, like, Ledger devices? You know, they claim that, you know, they're super secure and they have, like, this whole what do they call it, the dungeon or something like that, you know, their whole, like, security lab that just pries all day at trying to crack a Ledger. So why are TEs different, or are they, you know, is this just a misconception or lack of understanding of the technology?
Yeah I think SGX has gotten a lot of attention. The architectures are significantly different in the details, of course, but the core architecture and the core reliance on these kinds of supply chains remains the same. And I think in general, we can go more into that, how I think trusted execution environments can play a role in the future. I think they can play a role, but just this approach of using these systems and saying, well, so far we didn't see any exploits. So we can be sure that we can trust those systems and we can use them for all our future. I think that's a flawed approach, because at the end of the day, it's just the sort of non-provable blind trust. And in the case of Intel SGX, we've seen how fatal this can be, really. And I think what's important, and that's something that I think never seen anyone talk about when talking about these kinds of supply chains. In the case of Intel SGX, that's something that we've seen with different kinds of teams that use that technology, was that, there's this supply chain and trust into Intel, essentially, and the person that has access to the computer chip. But there's also someone who deploys the code for the enclave. And they upgrade the code, they give updates, and they have a private key they use to sign those updates. And so there's a single signing authority that can update whatever code. They can have their own local trusted execution environment, update the code, and exfiltrate information. And at the end of the day, in most crypto projects that use trusted execution environments, easiest single point of failure really is some development agency sitting on some island, I guess, that has a private key that has full control over everything. I think that's the most shocking aspect, and that's overlooked a lot when talking about the trust in the manufacturer. Most of the times, it's even simpler than that.
It's the $5 wrench attack. You have to get the boat to the island.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, yeah, that's super interesting. I guess we still haven't even talked about MPC, so let's get there. I guess, we're basically focusing on these hardware based models, but now we also have like purely cryptographically based privacy techniques. And how do they work? And what are their trade-offs, and how do you like navigate that trade-off space? I guess that's going to be the discussion for the next few minutes, hopefully.
Yeah, sure. So essentially, the other technologies are zero knowledge proofs, fully homomorphic encryption, and MPC. Zero knowledge proofs, we've spent a lot of time working with zero knowledge proofs, are great technology. And at the end of the day, zero knowledge proofs are even part of those FHE and MPC proving systems. So but CK snarks, those more prominent proving systems, they don't allow for what we are trying to achieve. What we're trying to achieve really is to be able to have some encrypted data, send it to some cloud environment, some blockchain network, whatever, send it to some computer and have it processed without that party that processes it having access to the data. And zero knowledge proofs are this two-party protocol where one party is the prover that has access to the data, and the second party, the verifier, not having access to the data. So zero knowledge proofs on their own can't allow for those autonomous confidential execution environments. FHE, fully homomorphic encryption, allows for that. Essentially, the definition of FHE would be to be able to execute arbitrary operations over encrypted data. So there's an encrypted representation of some state, and with FHE, two operations, essentially addition and multiplication, are homomorphic over that representation, which means that they yield an output that again lies in this representation. So that is a very, very good concept. The problem with FHE really is the practical usage of the technology, because the multiplications for fully homomorphic encryption result in noise accumulation, and noise accumulation requires bootstrapping. So bootstrapping operations essentially reduce the noise of this encrypted output. And if there's too much noise, that output can't be processed anymore. So bootstrapping is required, and that results in very high performance latencies and computational overhead. And that means that when using these kinds of FHE systems, there's many orders of magnitude performance latency associated. And so it's not unusual. And I think comparing the MPC protocols that we have with some FHE operations, it's not unusual for us to see something like us being faster 80,000 times, something like that. So incredible performance differences. And for very, very simple operations, FHE can be used. But more complex computations make this technology fail at the end of the day in practical implementations. And so the system that we are using is multi-party computation. And this multi-party computation uses so-called somewhat homomorphic encryption, SHE. And somewhat homomorphic encryption basically uses the efficient aspects of fully homomorphic encryption that we also utilize there. But for multiplications, there's a smart trick associated, I guess, that allows us to efficiently perform those multiplications as well. And so that's why this technology makes most sense. And on top of that, what's also very important to realize with FHE is that moving from encrypted representation to encrypted representation is very nice. But what if one wants to move out of the encrypted representation, right? If we have confidential on-chain applications and we want some transparent settlement to occur, there has to be a way to selectively disclose information about the encrypted state. And that's not possible with FHE by default. And with MPC, that becomes possible. And so trust model-wise, what's the case is that the trust models for systems in practice is the same for MPC and FHE applications, with MPC being many orders of magnitude faster. And so that's why we arrived at building those systems with MPC.
Super interesting. And do you think, like, I guess in general, this is also something that FHE can ever address in a way? Like, is it something that, you know, over time the algorithm will get better and, like, probably, right? I mean, but yeah, we'll be curious about that.
That mostly boils down to hardware acceleration. So hardware acceleration is what matters most for that. There will be significant improvements for sure. And what's important is that those hardware acceleration improvements also get utilized by this somewhat homomorphic encryption system in MPC. MPC still requiring network communication. That's one difference, requiring some more network communication. At the same time, FHE, in order to achieve verifiable compute with FHE, you also require consensus mechanisms if you do it in the blockchain setting. If verifiable compute, which is highly important for any computation, especially confidential computations, if verifiable compute is achieved without using consensus, there's even more significant performance slowdown. So hardware acceleration is what it boils down to. And I think these kind of hardware accelerations will also be utilizable for the MPC protocols, especially with recent advancements in those protocols, greatly reducing the need for network communication. So there's different options to be able to pack a lot more data within communication around. So I think at the end of the day, FHE will become more performant, but at this point in time, MPC just makes more sense. So it's always about being able to supply the required privacy technology at this point in time and for the next years. And so it's the same with fusion energy, I guess, right? We also need energy now and for the next 10 years without having fusion energy.
So does this work with any type of computation? Can you do? Can you perform really complex computations using Archimedes? And what languages can one write computations in? Does MPC, does this implementation support like specific languages? Can you maybe explain that?
How what we are trying to achieve essentially as the vision with Archimedes, and that's why I like to call it a supercomputer, really is for arbitrary program execution in a confidential encrypted way, but to also have the program itself be fully encrypted and to have encrypted random access memory, encrypted RAM, right? So to have a fully encrypted computer, you really have this sort of replacement for you purchasing some trusted execution environment. Now you can use this global supercomputer to execute anything, arbitrary programs that are essentially arbitrary encrypted RAM programs. The current stage we are at is that we support arbitrary computation support. And for that, we have a dedicated compiler that compiles arbitrary Rust code into the opcode microcode format that our network understands. Yeah, so one could essentially be writing assembly code, so on the opcode level, what the network understands. But what we offer mainly is this dedicated Rust compiler. Now, depending on the use case, different languages make more sense. So what we have at Archimedes right now is two distinct backends, two distinct MPC protocols. One MPC protocol that is highly focused on being as trustless as possible for especially on-chain applications. And we have another backend that is fine-tuned for floating point operations. So in order to perform operations over large matrices with floating points for machine learning. And so for that backend, we support a Python SDK essentially. So one can use TensorFlow and Pandas like they would normally and now have it be confidential and have one party hold this data, another party hold another data, and then collaboratively train some logistical regression or tree boosting model with that. So essentially Rust and Python for the machine learning applications is what I would say. Yeah.
Awesome. Let's maybe also take it back to like Archimedes as this network overall, right? Like, so we talked about, you know, why you're using MPC and confidential computation, but to achieve this at scale, right, there is a network and there is the crypto component of it. So can you provide us like a overview over the, you know, Archimedes structure architecturally as a crypto protocol and how that functions?
Essentially, Archimedes itself is a, you could say, stateless computing network. So we utilize existing ledgers, existing blockchains for state management and computation scheduling. So you can have your own smart contract on Solana, for example, that has confidential functionality. And this smart contract then calls an Archimedes smart contract that inserts a new computation within the Archimedes mempool. The network picks that up, executes the computation, and settles it back to the corresponding ledger. What's important is that the Archimedes network itself, you don't write a smart contract for Archimedes. You can use our smart contract SDK and build a confidential smart contract, but the network itself just runs confidential computations, and it picks those up from those dedicated on-chain mempools that can exist on different ledgers. And so I can build a confidential off-chain application and send such a computation request to the mempool, and it doesn't have to settle back to the dedicated smart contract. Now, how the network itself functions is essentially it's a permissionless network of nodes. And so The three of us could deploy a node in Archeum, and we could open a so-called computation cluster. So our computation cluster could now be used by anyone to run confidential computations. Or we could restrict that computation cluster to say, okay, we don't care about providing computational services to third parties. We just want to run our own confidential computations. So it's fully configurable. You can have clusters containing nodes from the network. You can run your own node. And what's so highly important about the trust model associated there is that it's the dishonest majority trust model. So any computational cluster only requires one participant to be honest, one participant that doesn't collaborate with all the other participants in a malicious way. So with that trust assumption, you can have arbitrarily sized computation clusters and associate them with a so-called MXE MPC execution environment. So that's essentially this virtual machine instance that you create as a developer. You create this virtual machine instance where you have encrypted state, you have your functions that can be called, essentially analogous to a smart contract, if you will. And that environment has one or more clusters associated that then process these kinds of computations. Now, the problem one on a theoretical level would run into is that such a computational cluster has this ideal trust assumption, only requiring the trust that one node is honest, right? Which for our blockchains we have with practical Byzantine fault tolerance, we have the honest majority trust assumption. And here, this honest majority trust assumption, one out of n, really is perfect. But the problem is that this also becomes highly dangerous for censorship, because one malicious party could also censor computations. And that really has in the past been a practical limitation for those very efficient and trustless MPC protocols. Because, yeah, deploying them in this permissionless setting could really mean that some malicious party could just DDoS the operation, essentially. And so what we have is a new kind of cryptographic protocol that allows to enforce execution and also correct execution for these computational clusters. So if you have this computational cluster, and our cluster in this example, and Sebastian just randomly decides to share some invalid data with me, at some point I will notice that invalid data has been shared, and I will stop the computation as I'm an honest participant. The problem now is that by default, Felix and I wouldn't be able to cryptographically identify that Sebastian was the one that caused the computation to fail by sharing invalid data. Now with our new protocol, we are able, and actually everyone in the world viewing our computation from the outside is able to identify that Sebastian is the one that caused the computation to fail. And what that means now is that we can punish Sebastian for causing the computation to fail. And so that's where blockchains really come into play, that we are able to enforce execution of those computations and enforce this kind of correct behavior. So we are able to add accountability to those computations, which makes it incredibly powerful now, because then even smaller sized clusters can be performant, run those computations, and the deployer of these clusters can be certain that execution will occur. And so that's where a staking and slashing mechanism comes into play.
So compared to other, you know, privacy projects out there, you know, how do you think Archeum is fundamentally different? Like, what is really the key differentiator that you guys are offering as a product?
Yeah, I think that really boils down to be trustless and performant at the same time. Because what we've seen really in the past is that that systems either require trust via trusted execution environments, or have incredible slowdowns with fully homomorphic encryption. And this sounds stupid, saying that as the founder of Archeum, but what I've seen in practice, and we are right now moving into our private testnet and have teams building with Archeum, really is seeing a lot of teams that have attempted building complex systems with FHE and pivoted to using Archeum because on the one hand it's easier to use, and on the other hand it just yields the performance requirements that applications require. And so I think that's really what it boils down to. And at the end of the day, all of that sort of is user experience, although trustlessness might be more hidden from the end user.
And in terms of applications, obviously there's applications here in crypto, and I'd love for you to maybe talk a little bit about some of the applications that you're seeing and that initial users are building. But applications here go beyond crypto. I think if we're talking about the trusted execution environment market, potentially clients of TEEs or companies that use TEEs could shift to using technologies like Archeum. Maybe also describe some of those use cases and efforts that you're making to address that part of the market as well.
Yeah, sure. So I think that's also one of the more interesting aspects to building Archeum, that it's not just solving problems in a crypto space, but solving problems for the entire world, for both enterprises, governments, any kind of organization, I think. That's also essential to the architecture design that we've designed. And I mentioned that earlier, that you as a developer don't have to deploy a smart contract or build a smart contract in order to run confidential computations. You're essentially just accessing this confidential computing network. And what that means is that on the crypto side of things, there's a lot of use cases, especially in DeFi and DePIN. There's a lot of teams building amazing stuff with our technology. I think something that is less important to the crypto space actually, and more important to the traditional computing space, is being able to run confidential AI, more specifically confidential machine learning with Archeum. Because in the past, confidential machine learning really hasn't been possible. And with this MPC-based confidential computing, what's so striking is that completely new types of digital interactions, I guess, become possible. Because if all of us have isolated data silos, isolated data sets of highly sensitive data that it on its own is valuable, right? All of us care about our privacy. We would never share that data. But this data, if we were able to, in some shape or form, pool it together and train AI models using that data, that could become very valuable. And I think a very striking example for that would be healthcare, right? So very sensitive patient data that now can be utilized in a trustless way. New models can emerge that can help all of us without any one of us ever having to expose their sensitive data. And this really is this collaborative element. And what we've seen is even logistic firms, right? So we are talking with logistic firms that want to improve supply chains regardless of blockchain. They don't care about blockchain. All they care about is not giving their sensitive supply chain data to competitors. But at the same time, they can improve the supply chains. They can all have this sort of win-win situation by using this trustless confidential computing technology. So I think that's really the power of decentralized confidential computing to address traditional markets as well. And that's also what drives us, that it's not just building applications for crypto's sake, but building applications for humanity's sake at the end of the day, I think.
So when considering the, you know, the Archeum network, I think one of the important things to consider here, and I'd love to get your take on this, is the censorship risk. So, you know, for in the case of like an application that would handle the healthcare data of like an entire nation, if we had like a small number of nodes, there would be a risk of censorship. And so therefore you'd probably want to have as many nodes as possible in there. Are there basically sort of exit mechanisms to prevent censorship? And also does the network performance, is the performance maintained as the number of nodes scale, or do we end up, you know, does that start decreasing as you add more nodes to the network?
Yeah, sure. So we have multiple mechanisms to combat censorship. I think the first mechanism that I outlined earlier is so-called, on a technical MPC level, it's called cheater identification. So to be able to cryptographically identify anyone who tries to stop a computation from occurring. And we can force everyone, game theoretically, to run a computation, otherwise they get slashed, they get punished. Now, if such a misbehavior happens and the misbehaving party doesn't care about losing all of their staked assets, there's fallback mechanisms. There's so-called cluster migration. So to be able to move from one cluster of nodes to a new cluster, there's also cluster forking mechanisms so that nodes that want to censor, because maybe there's some kind of computations happening where one node says, okay, I'm not comfortable processing these kinds of computations. So there's really also this tension of censorship because we want to force nodes to run any computation at the same time. There might be, based on where the node is being operated, also legal implications to not be able to process certain computations. And so we have both mechanisms. We can allow for nodes to say, okay, in the future, I will not want to process more computations for this corresponding MXE. And they can do that. They need to pay for the so-called cluster forking then. And there can also be those forceful migrations if a node just doesn't jointly compute the function that they have to compute.
Right, maybe taking it back to the use cases for like a potential final question. We talked a lot about Archeum being this platform, and actually you already also mentioned initially you were building like this confidentiality thing on Elusive, right? Like kind of more application focused almost, or I guess in general, the Elusive product was more application. Now you're this platform, and obviously if you're a platform, you have to do like ecosystem building. You're mentioning you've been speaking to a lot of like logistics firm, like in healthcare, like traditional businesses. And I think you also like mentioned, like you yourselves met in the Hacker House, right, in Solana, which I think quite interesting and probably one of the best ecosystem building examples in all of crypto in the recent years, right? Seeing like it brought also you together and just generally how successful Solana has been with that. So yeah, the question basically is like, how are you approaching this? How are you getting people to build on the Archeum platform?
Yeah, so we currently have way too many people trying to build on Archeum. That's the current status. So a few months back, when we announced Archeum, we started accepting developer and node operator signups for the private testnet, which we started rolling out. And currently, we are in the cohort one phase. So the first group of developers that get hands-on support from us, get access to all of the tooling and can start building applications. And step by step, we are expanding those cohorts and adding more teams. So folks can join our Discord, can register to be able to be accepted to those private testnet development rounds, and then they get full access to Archeum and can build their applications and get development support from our end.
That's congrats on the success there for sure. Yeah, I hope we'll see like a bunch of cool applications. Seb, anything else from your point or?
No, I'm just like always amazed that like these technologies, you know, as great as they are, you know, the technologies that we really need, you know, like private compute, like more privacy technologies are not the ones in crypto that, you know, get the most attention or get the most capital. And so I'm just really glad to see Arkium raise $5.5 million recently and, you know, from some pretty big VCs and hopefully like take this technology to market, because I think it's really important. You know, I also at some point, you know, brought all my family to Signal and thought that was a really big achievement. Even though, you know, Signal might be backdoored and we have no real way of finding out, you know, but yeah, I think like this stuff is important. And it's also political. I think, you know, we shouldn't forget that like encryption is a political issue more than just a technological issue. And so I'm glad we can talk about it here on this podcast. Thanks for coming on, Yannick.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you for joining us on this week's episode. We release new episodes every week. You can find and subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you have a Google Home or Alexa device, you can tell it to listen to the latest episode of the Epicenter podcast. Go to epicenter.tv/subscribe for a full list of places where you can watch and listen. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for the newsletter so you get new episodes in your inbox as they're released. If you want to interact with us, the guests, or other podcast listeners, you can follow us on Twitter. And please leave us a review on iTunes. It helps people find the show, and we're always happy to read them. So thanks so much, and we look forward to being back next week.